ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
I'm David Marr, host of Late Night Live on Radio National.
Very suave, erudite kind of guy.
We're here to surprise, delight, and maybe enrage you from time to time. We go where our curiosity leads.
Let's talk crazy. Let's act crazy. Let's be crazy, because then the enemy doesn't know what you're thinking.
Late Night Live, four new shows a week on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Another gunman targets the US president.
And the White House targets the media over its demonization of Trump.
From Abraham Lincoln to the Kennedys to Ronald Reagan,
political violence in America is on repeat.
On this episode of Global Roaming, we try to come to grips with why.
I'm Latika Burke.
And I'm Geraldine Doogue. Welcome to Global Roaming. Yes, Latika, it's certainly a bracing week to try to think through why this has happened again in the US. But also what I've been focusing on is trying to actually read more about that young gunman, the 31-year-old Cole Allen, who's now been charged with attempted assassination of the president and various firearms charges. You know, that amazing moment of hearing him say to the judge who asked him in court, in effect, do you understand your rights? What level of education do you have? And he said, master's level, master's of engineering.
Yes, Geraldine, you know, I am so worried that we have reached a tipping point also with how we react and respond to these sorts of events in the United States. For example, there used to be a time where a mass shooting would happen in the US and it was terrifying, scary, horrible, appalling, and it would dominate the news for days, if not weeks. Now we've had three attempted assassination attempts of the president. And I've got to say, waking up, it was almost a, oh yeah, you know, it was big news, obviously, but I do wonder if it's, maybe it's just me, Geraldine, but I do wonder if we're becoming a little numb to the extremities that are taking place in political discourse now.
Well, I mean, we're talking just after the 30th anniversary of the Port Arthur massacre in Australia. Certainly Australia did not just say, oh, well, you know, let's go forward. You know, this is in the everyday. I think in Australia, it fundamentally changed a lot of attitudes. So why doesn't it in the US? I agree with you. I was the same. I'm sort of vaguely horrified. I thought, oh, yes, I thought another one. But that's something very much of the US, isn't it?
I have been pondering this. Is it because of Trump that we're so used to everything that you didn't think would happen? Or is it because we've become numb to gun violence in the United States?
Well, look, I suppose I think that if a country finds it extremely difficult to self-correct after something like the Sandy Hook massacre of those kindergarten children all those years ago when Barack Obama was, in a funny sort of a way, you do protect yourself. You think, well, if they can't deal with that, so obviously the innocents mowed down, and then they one way or the other, their political system could not carve through the various interest groups involved. You sort of say, well, I'm not going to give too much of my emotion to them. That's how I think I don't even know that I sort of consciously thought it through, but I think that's what I did do.
It's actually reassuring to hear you say that, because I had exactly this thought process this afternoon. And I too think that Sandy Hook was the one where we all crossed that line. You know, what's been so fascinating about this reaction is the swiftness of the political blame game, the exploitation that's gone on from every single corner. It's been so, so quick and I might say pretty effective, I think. But what I was looking for in every single question and answer was, is this about gun control? Yes, Trump is right. A whack job can be a whack job. You can get radicalized. America is polarized. But not every country has that third added dimension of easy access to a gun. America almost uniquely has this, and Trump was shrugging this off. This complete, you know, you use the word, I think, impossibility, unwillingness to even say, look, maybe gun laws are part of this problem. Not all of it, but part of it. I guess I shouldn't be surprised anymore, but it does continually confound me, particularly after Bondi, the way that we all reacted to looking at gun laws straight away.
Our guest today on Global Roaming was at the event when that gunman fired his gun in the lobby. David Smith is The Guardian's Washington Bureau Chief, a position he's held for nearly a decade now. On Saturday night, he attended the dinner in his tuxedo, no doubt, and today he's just ditched a garden party for King Charles to be with us, but I gather in some rather unusual circumstances. David, welcome to Global Roaming.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Now, I know you witnessed the events and were there. You've written about the events on Saturday night, but you've got to tell us where you are right now, please.
Right now, I'm speaking to you from the British Embassy in Washington. It's a beautiful day. We're in a big garden, lots of politicians and journalists and others milling about, and we're here for the state visit by King Charles and Queen Camilla. And as I speak to you, I'm watching them in the distance, almost getting mobbed by people eager to talk to them as they're on a walkabout and greeting guests at this party.
So take us in the room on Saturday night. What did you see, and at what point do you realize or clock that this might be an assassination attempt?
Yeah, I mean, I've been going to the White House Correspondents' Dinner for many years now, and it's a familiar routine as you go into this vast subterranean ballroom at the Washington Hilton. There's about 2,000 people really crammed in, and we took our seats at our big round table with a white linen tablecloth. And what was different this year, of course, is that Donald Trump was actually attending as president. He's normally snubbed it. And he came in, the national anthem was played, he saluted, he took his seat. And for around 40 minutes, it was one of these gala dinners. People are chatting, the room's buzzing. We were eating salad, drinking wine. And then suddenly, of course, very abruptly, everything changed. And I heard a loud noise, a banging towards the back of the ballroom. I had no idea what it was. As Trump himself said later, you weren't quite sure if it was just some kind of accident of plates being dropped. But when I looked around, I could see some commotion and people diving for cover, guests ducking under these tables. And, the radical conformist that I am, I thought, okay, maybe I'd better dive under the table too, as did my fellow guests. Had no real idea why I was doing it or what was happening. And then there was a kind of eerie silence for some time. No one was quite sure what would happen next. When I got up to look at the stage, I could see that Donald Trump, First Lady Melania Trump, Vice President J.D. Vance and others had been taken away, rushed off the stage by the Secret Service. And then minute by minute, a gradual kind of weird normality descended on the room. You know, people got back in their seats and milled around and chatted. And obviously, gradually, the picture became clearer and Trump put a post on Truth Social telling us a bit more about what had happened with regard to this this intruder who had rushed towards the ballroom.
David, you all then very quickly seemed to decamp back to the White House for this press conference with the president, still wearing his dinner suit. What did you make of the tone he struck, and particularly in comparison to how he responded after Butler, Pennsylvania, when, of course, he was shot in the ear?
Yeah, I thought it was very reminiscent of Butler, Pennsylvania, that assassination attempt where, of course, a bullet nicked his ear and he got up off the stage, fist aloft, shouting, fight, 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 with blood on his face. It became an iconic image and a potential turning point in that election campaign. And I think Trump is a showman and a master of media, and he knew, again, this was a great opportunity for him to project strength and defiance. So, I actually lingered in the ballroom for quite some time. There were messages coming saying that perhaps this dinner would go ahead after all. And I'm sure Trump was pushing hard for that. He said he was, because that would allow him to look like a brave, defiant leader. And in the end, the White House press conference pretty much served the same purpose.
This climate within which you're working now, David, you talk about, for instance, you quote John Cohen, a former Undersecretary for Intelligence in Homeland Security, who said, "This is the most volatile, complex and dangerous threat environment I've experienced in the 40 plus years I've been involved in law enforcement and Homeland Security. We're an angry, polarised nation. We have a growing number of people, particularly young males, who believe violence is the only way to express their sense of grievance, etc., etc." So, I, you know, just you as an Englishman there observing this place, like, can you feel people trying to pull it back, or is it just all gloves off?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, probably the central question really of my 10 years in Washington reporting on Trump and the Trump era in a very politically polarized society. And there has been a surge of political violence in that time, everything from, you know, a shooting at a congressional baseball practice to the January the 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol, the killing of the right-wing activist Charlie Kirk and state politicians at various levels. And members of Congress say they're seeing record numbers of threats and they're hiring private security in some cases, and some are just giving up and retiring because the hatred is so great. What are the causes? I think some of Trump's divisive, incendiary rhetoric, sometimes glorifying in violence, is part of it. Another accelerant is social media and those echo chambers and the way that encourages some of this tribalism. And the politicians really frame every election as an Armageddon election. You know, if we lose, if the other side comes to power, you know, it's the end of America as we know it. All your values will be wiped out. And so the stakes are so high. And you do even hear some academics wondering about the possibility of a second American Civil War. I mean, they say it would look very different from the first one. But they're conscious that this is a society awash with guns, of course. And I think the fact that there are more guns than people and the fact that there are more smartphones than people are you know, crucial factors in all of this.
But for instance, I was thinking, in other countries, when things like this occur, I suggest that there's earlier a response to mental health concerns in the country. You know, how are we treating people who are clearly troubled and falling through the net? And there's a sort of a more or less fairly soon, the systems of handling difficult people start to be reassessed. I don't hear that happening nearly as much, but you can tell me if I'm wrong, from the US.
There are activists who are saying our gun laws are madness. We should curb that. Our mental health approach needs radical change. I mean, you know, they get it. Unfortunately, in recent years, those voices have been on the minority or on the back foot. Obviously, Donald Trump's election in 2024 led to I think, a lot of backlash against some of that side of the equation. You know, I think, you know, things can change again. But the gun laws is a fundamental difference from many parts of the world. It's, you know, it's written into the Constitution. It's part of the culture. It's seen as part of freedom. And again, there are some Americans I just read who were saying, you know, an incident like this happens and the rest of the world looks at us and asks, you know, why are you not debating these issues? And the rest of the world thinks we're just crazy.
I'm Latika Burke with Geraldine Doog. You're listening to Global Roaming. Our guest today is David Smith, Washington Bureau Chief with The Guardian. What to make of the alleged attacker, Cole Allen? He's a teacher, young male. Most people would look at a profile of a man like this and never think he might become a would-be mass shooter. What is the debate in America about his profile?
Yeah, that's right. He seemed to have a lot going for him and a good education and be you know, fairly successful teacher and you know, academic qualifications. And clearly this was premeditated. He took the train all the way from California to Washington, which generally people don't. I guess that was a way to evade security. He stayed at the hotel, which again sort of got him through some of the security protocols, and reportedly he wrote this very detailed manifesto about his disgust and contempt for the Trump administration, and, you know, apologizing to friends and family about what he was going to do. And I think that will be something reporters will investigate in the coming weeks, just what was the trigger for him that pushed him over the edge.
I noticed Michael Wolff. He did quite a serious piece to camera the other day I saw where he said, this is the turn. This is the beginning of the end of Trump. He will be gradually deserted by everybody. Watch it. I'm saying it now. Now, what do you think of a prophecy like that? Like, do you see anything? You know, people are now openly questioning whether he's in some form of senile dementia. You sense that something is shifting looking on from Australia, but you tell me.
I hear Michael Wolff's prediction. I'm also aware Trump has been written off many times before, only to bounce back. And you could argue he's the luckiest man in the world, thinking back to the rally in Pennsylvania. And you know, events just seem to turn up to give him a boost when he needs it. And certainly Saturday night's drama helped to change the conversation from the Iran war, for example, which is very unpopular and has pushed his approval rating down. But yeah, I think we're entering that final 1,000 days, the final sort of couple of years of the Trump era, could be the most intriguing and most dangerous of all. A lot depends on November's midterm elections. The polls suggest that Trump's Republican Party will take a hammering, probably lose the House of Representatives and maybe even lose the Senate as well. And in normal times, that would really turn the president into a lame duck for his final 2 years. It would be a slow, gradual fade to black with not much happening. Now, can Trump accept such a fate, or will he lash out? Will he become even more reckless? Will he feel, okay, I now have nothing to lose? I mean, all of these are possibilities. It is quite hard to imagine him just going gently into that good night and handing over the torch to an anointed Republican successor. So, it's tough to face, but the wildest chapter may be yet to come.
David, going back to the comparison with Butler, Pennsylvania, I remember watching that thinking this election is over, Trump has won. Do you think there's any possibility that this also forms some kind of popularity boost for Trump, or we're too far into his presidency now for that to have any effect in the same way?
I think a fleeting, in a short, medium term, probably not lasting. You know, unlike Pennsylvania, this did not produce a defining image. That was pretty extraordinary, the way there were photographs of Trump with blood on his face and his fist raised. And you know, to this day, his supporters still chant fight, fight, fight. And they wear T-shirts with that photograph. In this instance, he was shoved off stage in a Washington ballroom. And in fact, I saw some reporting, some journalists just commenting on some of the dissonance that the same night they went to some bars in Washington, just a few blocks away down the road, there were people there who didn't even know this had happened and probably didn't care much. And this journalist was saying, you know, a couple of generations ago when there were assassination attempts on presidents like Gerald Ford and obviously the Reagan one, it was a huge talking point. Every TV screen was tuned to that. There was still that sense of national solidarity. This one, of course, you know, it's hugely magnified because you had a bunch of journalists in the room and they're all absolutely obsessed with it. I suspect many members of the American public have already sort of starting to shrug and move on.
It is worth remembering his polls are absolutely plummeting. There is quite strong talk that some of his key lieutenants, people like Kash Patel, goodness me, what is unfolding around him is another story altogether. Lutnick, I think he's the Treasury, he's the Finance Secretary, and Tulsi Gabbard might well go in the next little while, which would again be a very different look for this presidency. In the midst of inflation finished off Joe Biden. I wonder, you know, something as basic as inflation, could it actually continue to undermine Donald Trump in much more sort of prosaic ways than we're talking about at the moment?
Yeah, I think it's a great point that, we all obsess with the big picture issues of the Iran war and Trump and Putin and his mental health and all of that. But, a couple of weeks ago, I went to Kentucky to interview Trump voters, and you know, their big concern was the cost of petrol, cost of fuel. how much it, you know,
eggs,
whether they can budget for the week. Yes, that's right. Bread and butter issues. And you're even hearing now some advice for Democrats coming from Hungary, where Viktor Orban was defeated, that says, you know, don't talk about the big philosophical ideas of democracy. Concentrate on cost of living and tie it to the corruption of the leadership. And in the American context, you know, Trump's opponents should point to the corruption around him and his family and how they've enriched themselves. So, yeah, I think, you know, Donald Trump ran for election promising to lower prices. He's failed to do that. Prices have actually gone up for a range of reasons, including the Iran war. And certainly, I think Republicans in Congress right now are panicking about that and what it means for their electoral fortunes. I mean, as we've mentioned, I'm speaking to you from a garden party of the British Embassy. I asked a Republican senator, you know, how are you feeling about the midterms? And his reply was, we're going to get creamed, certainly as things stand right now. There is, however, a slightly haunting question lingering over all of that, which is, does Donald Trump actually care? Because as far as we know, and as far as the Constitution says, he doesn't have to run again. This doesn't affect him directly. How much does he actually care about?
David, he has expressed a lot of concern about being impeached if the House goes the other way, hasn't he?
Yes, that's right.
Maybe he does care.
Yeah, he certainly said that if Democrats win, they may try to impeach him. Of course, that in itself can be complicated because there are certainly some who feel it would actually potentially rebound on the Democrats, and Trump would relish using the impeachment to say, I was right all along. This is a big witch hunt against me. So yeah, who knows how it will play out. You're absolutely right. Trump's approval rating right now appears to be as an all-time low.
And just quickly, the Democrats themselves then sitting there, I mean, I just constantly see discussions advising the Democrats what they should and shouldn't be doing. How do you see it?
Yeah, I mean, if anybody can mess up this election and shoot themselves in the foot, it's possibly the Democratic Party. They have a habit of snatching defeat from the jaws of victory. I think they could probably learn some lessons from last year's elections, where Democrats did extremely well in Virginia, New Jersey, and of course, Zoran Mamdani in New York. And they really did have a focus there on affordability, on the cost of living, on prices. I worry on Democrats' behalf that they may now be slightly overplaying that. Like you can go up to a Democrat and ask them a question about Iran or you know, Artemis II going to the moon, and they'll somehow pivot back to affordability very quickly in the same answer. So there's a danger of being a little robotic and mechanical with it. But I think what impacts people's lives is important. And you know, showing that they can get things done, you know, pointing to examples of Democratic governors and mayors who've actually achieved things. Because, yeah, to be frank, right now, the approval rating of Democrats is also pretty low. So they do have to rebuild trust, and they have to find authenticity, which Zoran Mamdani certainly had in New York. I think the party has an image problem. It's seen as too elitist and artificial and pandering, and, you know, trying to look good on social media without really knowing how to do it. And they've got to find charismatic candidates.
David, what do you know about David Bratt, who President Trump has announced will be the next ambassador to Australia?
I mean, my understanding is he's a Trump loyalist, and he made a splash in American politics really, the start of a new era, when, as an insurgent candidate, he defeated Eric Cantor, who was a big name in those days. And that was one of the canaries in the coal mine, telling us that the Republican Party was shifting to something more right-wing and more populist, and that the establishment was on the way out. And yeah, it'd be interesting to see if he brings that approach to diplomacy with Australia.
Yes. All right, David, thanks so much. Get back to meeting the King and the Queen.
Cheers, all the best.
Well, Geraldine, I felt quite reassured about that, because he answered the question we were asking each other, which is, were we wrong to feel just a little bit numb? But apparently many Americans felt a little bit numb about the third assassination attempt on Donald Trump too.
Yes, and that whole question of what, as I've heard it put the other day, what toxins he's released in the American political system, and whether, you know, you can, using that sort of pharmaceutical analogy, whether you can go back.
We kind of forget that it has been a 10-year journey for Trump. It's not just these last few years. It's not just the pre-election campaign. It's been a 10-year, it's been a decade of Trump in our minds, front and centre.
Yes, it's an extraordinary time. And look, I must just say we've got a lot of feedback on our Anzac Day episode, particularly about the tension between deterrence and disarmament, Latika, which you raised, from Rob. I refuse to accept that we need more or bigger weapons to act as a deterrent. In my opinion, people who have weapons are willing to escalate quickly to use them. I feel safer in Australia because I know that no one on my street owns a gun. I know the diplomacy would be impossible, but the world needs the same policy. If nobody has weapons, then nobody should feel afraid.
Well, I'm certainly not talking about every Tom, Dick and Harry on the street having a gun, and anyone listening to this episode would certainly know my position on that. What I am talking about is countries making themselves as strong and resilient as possible, so that if anyone comes looking or knocking on the door, they think, gee, that barking dog sounds a bit scary. I might leave that Rottweiler alone just today.
Yes, you did put that well. And I take the view that, like, the people like the Gareth Evans of this world took the view that that was the great yield of the Cold War, that we reduced dramatically the number of weapons who could have obliterated us all. And now we seem to be going back the other way, which, well, I find very difficult. Mark also sent in quite the essay, I must say, in response to our Anzac Day episode. Here's just an excerpt. Won't China take us all over if we don't spend money on arms? I hear all of you, particularly Latika and Geraldine, asked, did I say that? I and many commentators don't think so. Xi has his own domestic problems that a war and its associated trade disruption would exacerbate and damage the CCP's grip on power. A true realpolitik solution might be the acceptance of a soft takeover of Taiwan by China in return for lessening support for Russia, perhaps.
Finally, Geraldine, from Bill. Many might think Australian vulnerability is to the Chinese military that we need to build up so that Xi would think twice. I think this is faulty thinking. If Australia is a good and reliable trading partner and seen to deal fairly with all, why invade us? Can you imagine trying to take over Australia? I think this is, again, a bit of a misnomer. China's not going to invade Australia. The problem is its economic dominance gives it control and may stop or soften our own foreign policy decision-making. That's the point. We are a trading nation. We cannot cope or survive. Look what's happening with oil, for goodness sakes. We could not cope if somebody with malevolent or hostile intent took over the sea lanes upon which we rely to trade as a nation. We do need to be a lot more nuanced in what we talk about here when we talk about Australia's defence and security resilience. It's not as simple or as binary as China might invade us.
The debate we have to have, Latika. Okay. Thank you very much indeed to all our listeners. And we're really delighted, actually, at the response. We'll try to do a few more of those when we can, of the four of us together. Don't forget to write to us. Our email is global.roaming@abc.net.au. Thanks to our producers on this episode, Aston Brown, and our executive producer, Kylie Morris.
Tomorrow it's Kylie and myself back with another fascinating conversation dipping into Iran. And of course, some more of your feedback. We love it, honestly.
Bye-bye.
See you.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.